What goes up must come down. Then go up, then come down again, then go up, then come down again. I could go on all day, y'all. Volatility is the word. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. February the 3rd, it is Wednesday. Great to have you along, everybody. A data point with which to start things off, all right? 415. That was the point swing on the Dow Jones Industrial Average today from the low of the session to the high. Almost the very definition of the volatility we've been having since the beginning of the year. We've gone over the various explanations for it, right? Maybe China, maybe oil, maybe central banks, maybe a lot of things, who knows? But we forget sometimes, though, that what volatility actually is millions of little choices made by a giant community of investors out there, all placing different bets on where they think the market is going to go. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison pulls back the curtain on volatility from New York.
If you look at market volatility like a physicist, the atoms are single moments when an investor gets a piece of news. Imagine you're that investor and the news is about company stock you own. Should you sell, hold, or buy more? It's not an easy call, even if you're a Nobel laureate economist like NYU professor Rob Engel, who studies this stuff.
Every piece of information is ambiguous. There's rarely a piece of information that says the stock is going to be worth 2% more tomorrow or 2% less.
Let's say you think the news is bad enough to sell. Who's going to buy your shares? The market's collectively seeing the same news as you, so you're going to have to settle for a lower price. And maybe others get the same idea, explains trading floor veteran Ted Weisberg, founder of Seaport Securities.
When you get downdrafts in the market, selling begets selling.
The price drops and voila, volatility. It also happens on the upside. You just don't hear many complaints when stocks are climbing. When the market's nuts, some people like to point fingers at mom and pop investors, but they're a small fraction of the U.S. stock market. And even though the pros have more training and experience, there's plenty of research to show they can fall victim to bias, panicking and following the herd regardless of what the data show. Jim Angel is a professor at Georgetown's Business School.
Even though professional money managers should be more rational than regular people, the reality is they're human.
And those humans are all over the map as to where they think the market is going, which is why it's volatile now and probably will be for a while. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Pens are being put to paper this evening in New Zealand. It's a signing ceremony for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that giant and not completely uncontentious trade deal that's pending between the United States and 11 other countries. Something like 30% of global trade hangs in the balance on this thing. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is here from the TPP desk with an update. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
So remind me where we are in this whole long process that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would you?
Right. Okay. So if you think about when a bill becomes law, usually the last thing that you'll see is President Obama signing it. This is not that. We are not we are not there. This is one step in a very long process, but there are lots of other steps that need to happen.
All right, like what?
For example, there's this big assessment of the economic impact of the deal that the U.S. International Trade Commission has to put together. That'll probably be out in May.
Yeah.
And then we need to draft legislation that actually puts into law all the stuff that's been agreed to in the text of this agreement, all those thousands of pages. And Congress needs to vote on that.
Well, speaking of Congress, right, you had Speaker Ryan at the House yesterday, other congressional leaders. Given that this is the big legislative thing on the president's agenda this year, you have to believe it came up, right? And when it's going to get taken care of?
It definitely came up. We know they talked about it, but we still don't have a timeline and the path forward is very unclear. So in a call with reporters yesterday, U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman on his way to New Zealand, he just kept saying that they're looking for the most conducive window. So when is that? You know, it's really tough to say. Is it before the elections? Is it after the elections? The elections are a big complication in this process.
Spin that out a little bit, because there's kind of an unusual alignment of people not real happy with this deal.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you think about who traditionally supports a big trade agreement like this, usually you have support on the Republican side and Democrats less so. Mm-hmm. And especially in an election year, this is a tough sell for Democrats. They want to be very wary of what their constituents think. They want to be wary of organized labor, mm-hmm. Which by and large does not support this agreement. And if you think about on the Republican side, that traditional support, it's been much more cautious or tepid this time. Mm.
Remind me what happens when Congress finally gets this thing. There is fast-track authority, which means no amendments, just an up or down vote, right? How's that going to go?
Ambassador Froman has said he is not interested in renegotiating pieces of this agreement. Mm. He does not want to go down that rabbit hole. So then how do you address the parts of it that people don't like? It's hard. Froman talked about stressing how the deal would be implemented and enforced. He talked about highlighting specific companies and constituents who would benefit from the pact with lawmakers to, you know, go to people in their districts. And using groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers who have recently endorsed the agreement. But it's hard. It's really hard to change minds on this issue, especially in an election year.
Especially. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson on the next steps for the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Tracy, thanks a bunch.
Anytime.
All that volatility on the Dow aside, it was kind of a meh day on Wall Street today, a very meh day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I was down in Texas a couple of weeks ago, El Paso, for our election year series, My Economy. I wound up talking to a bunch of people while I was there, including this woman.
Gina Olvera.
How old are you, Gina?
I'm 20.
It was morning, 9 o'clock or so, and Gina was on her way to work. Where do you work?
KFC.
KFC. She does this walk 6 days a week. She's studying to be a nurse.
I cross like 4 days of the week, and school 2 days.
So every day, pretty much, you're across the border. Like, and she's a new mom.
It's pretty, like, complicated because I'm starting, like, school and work and a child, but it's fine.
What makes her life really complicated, though, is where she lives.
And what is?
It's a short walk as the crow flies, barely a mile. But it can take her as long as 2 hours because even though Gina is an American citizen, she lives in Mexico and works in the U.S.,
I work here in Juarez is more better. It's
how come?
Because, like, the dollar in Juarez is more.
You get paid in dollars, and you spend money in pesos.
Yeah.
I met Gina at the foot of the Paso del Norte Bridge. It's one of three crossings between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. More than 70,000 people make that crossing every single day. People who don't just split their lives between countries, but between the local and global economies, too.
The life and the kind of job that I want.
Prosperity.
Providing for your children.
My head above water.
My economy.
My economy.
My economy.
When you look at it big picture, the American economy is enormous, an $18 trillion beast, as we're telling you all the time. But if you look a little bit closer, you realize it's actually just a collection of stories. Stories of us, of how we feel and how we're getting by. That's the backdrop for our series, My Economy. And this week, some stories from the borderland. That slice of the country that's more susceptible to the global economy than most of the rest of us are. Just off the Paso del Norte Bridge in El Paso, where we met Gina, there are more than 300 shops catering to the traffic that comes off that bridge. Open storefronts spill goods out into the streets. They're stacked and piled and hung. And on the corner of El Paso Street and 4th Avenue, rows and rows of mannequins from the waist down only, all dressed in denim.
I've never seen more jeans in my life.
It's a shop called Crystal Jeans, and it's owned by this guy.
My name is Jorge Hernandez. I grew up here, born and raised in El Paso, Texas. I started working for the family business when I was about 16 years old. I raised my family, and now we've got the third generation taking over the daily operations of things.
And we should say we're just off the foot of the bridge from Juarez.
About 3 blocks away from the International Bridge.
So I imagine when the peso is strong and people come here with some money in their pocket, this is the place to be.
Absolutely.
This is really a story of the foreign exchange markets, of what happens to American businesses when, as we've been telling you lately, an already strong U.S. dollar gets even stronger. As it's been going up, the Mexican peso has been falling. The peso has lost almost 40% of its value against the greenback in just the past 2 years. More than three quarters of Jorge's business comes from Mexicans, so he's taken a hit.
Our sales have decreased, I'd say, a good 35% this year.
35%?
Yes, sir.
So what do you do? I mean, how do you run a business when what happens is not in your control, right? That's the question. You don't have control over the local economy because it's part of the global economy.
We start, sadly, laying people off.
Have you done that already?
Yes, we have.
How many?
We've cut our workforce right now, I'd say about 50%.
50? 50?
Yes, 50%. We laid off half of our employees right now.
That's terrible.
It is.
Is there a chance you would close this up? Shut it down?
I would like to think not, but that's not something that I can really tell you at this point in time. There's only so much that you could do to keep your doors open.
Yeah. Of course, when American goods get more expensive for Mexicans, Mexican goods get cheaper for Americans. And that's real nice for the owner of this upscale shop across town.
My name is Deanna Williams-Heffley, and we are at the Desert Gypsy, my Mexican import store in El Paso, Texas.
She sells high-end Mexican arts and crafts. Paintings and blown glass, Day of the Dead figurines are all over the place.
It's difficult to get everything across. It's difficult to send money back and forth. The vendors who I've developed a relationship with, who I buy from frequently, give me their banking information, and I walk over to Juarez or I drive over to Juarez and I deposit into their bank accounts. And then they ship to me. So it's based on the honor system.
Deanna spent a lot of time in Mexico growing up. She's got a house down there now, and she says that really helped her figure out how to get things done.
If I didn't have a home in Mexico, I would not be able to do this. I know how to maneuver there, and I know how to maneuver here. And that way I've got one foot on each side.
One foot in, one foot out. That's how a lot of small business owners in El Paso operate, some more literally than others.
My name is Emmanuel Urbina. You're at my store located in El Paso, Texas. We're Barrio Skate Shop. We also have a store just like this one over in Juarez.
The Barrio Skate Shop is back near the border, down by the bridge. It's all painted black on the inside. Brightly colored skateboard decks and shoes are hung all over the walls, though. Emmanuel moved to El Paso from Mexico when he was a kid, learned retail from his dad, he says, and now he's got twin skate shops, one on each side of the border, and he figures he's in a real good spot.
El Paso is this really, really special place. All the large retailers have the best performing stores around this border area. A lot of people ask themselves, well, why? It's surrounded by poverty. Well, here's why. Since the demographics lend themselves to poverty, a lot of the people here don't have credit cards or debit cards. So it's still a cash economy. It's wonderful for the retailers. The malls, it's unlike anything in the U.S. They're still collecting cash. So here I am.
Tell me about the logistics of literally being a cross-border businessman. I mean, you've got stores in both locations. I imagine you want to keep an eye on them both. How do you do that?
Well, both stores are about a quarter of a mile from the bridge. I have found that the quickest way to get over the border is to use a skateboard, kind of not very traditional to, you know, show up at, you know, a customs checkpoint with a board. Especially a man like myself, you know, I'm 37 years old and they see me with a board, but it's really tough. The wait times at the bridge can go up to like 4 hours.
So, I mean, how many days a week are you over there? I mean, do you go every day? Does it?
Almost every day.
Wow.
Almost every day.
Wow.
Why not? You know, I got to.
Would you be running your business differently if you were in, I don't know, San Antonio, which is like 200 miles from the border, or
I wouldn't,
you know,
exist.
Phoenix or something?
I wouldn't exist. This is here because of this cross-border traffic.
Well, because I got to tell you, here we are. It's like noon on a Thursday, and there's not a soul in here except us.
I'm break-even. I'm living the American dream, but it's a break-even American dream. We have one strong variable going on against all of us here in El Paso and other border communities, and that's the devaluation of the peso or the appreciation of the dollar, whichever way you want to look at it. I've just kept with this idea that things on the border will get better and this cross-border traffic will come back and this tourism will exist again. You know, I'm just trying to position myself to be one of these businesses. I dreamt big, I'm dreaming big, and I'm shooting for the stars. But, you know, I've got to make sure that today we get some sales here and that all the bills get paid.
Paying the bills, getting by, a trickier proposition when your economy is the global economy.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, Living Your Economic Life on Both Sides of the Rio Grande. We'll take a trip across the Paso del Norte Bridge into Juarez. But in the meanwhile, you can check us out online. Pictures and videos of the people we met and the places we went in El Paso. Emmanuel and the Skate Shop, the Shopping District with all those blue jeans, of course, and the Paso del Norte Bridge as well. It's all online at marketplace.org. Coming up,
the fact that we're still having this conversation about Americans being recruited into the jihad is kind of pretty extraordinary on one level.
Homegrown jihadis, who they are and how they got that way. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 183 points today, 1.1%, 16,336 for the blue chips. The Nasdaq down 12 points, about 0.25%, 4504. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.5%. 1912. Chipotle Mexican Grill chomped down 2.9%. The restaurant chain said sales were hurt more than initially expected by the E. coli outbreak at some of its stores. Duh. Fears of loans going bad continues to hit banks. Today, Morgan Stanley gave up 0.75%. Bank of America shrank 1.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-notes rose to 1.88%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're among the legions out there sporting an activity tracker right now, Fitbits are probably the best-known brand name. If you've got one on and you're trying to hit that magical 10,000 steps, consider this for just a second. What if you had to reach that number or you'd get dinged on your performance review? In the college version of that, this year Oral Roberts University started requiring their incoming freshmen to wear Fitbits and walk 10,000 steps a day. It goes into their grades, and now the school is encouraging all of its students to join in. Healthy body, healthy mind, and all that. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
Oral Roberts isn't the only school torturing its students. At Cornell, students have to be able to jump feet first into the deep end and swim 75 yards to graduate. Columbia, MIT, and a bunch of others also have exercise requirements. There's a scientific case to be made here. John Rady of Harvard Medical School has written a book on the subject.
We know from many, many sources that the more fit the children are, the better their test scores.
Rady says fitness improves memory, creativity, and other measures. But that's not the main reason virtually all colleges used to make students exercise. Rady says they did it as...
in a preparation for war, for soldiering and all that.
Now, schools are waging a different kind of war, on late graduation. Steve Mitchell is a professor of physical education at Kent State University.
College educations are expensive, and I think the perception perhaps is that for subjects that are not central to an undergraduate major, perhaps they should no longer be required.
And they're not, at all but 39% of colleges today. Instead, most schools encourage physical activity, like that elective tennis class I took in college. I got a D-.
Actually, you had a poor teacher who did you a disservice.
Dennis Hochef, my new favorite person, heads the Department of Nutrition and Kinesiology at the University of Central Missouri. He says the most productive kind of health education is the one that builds habits.
If we have a quality health and wellness program that includes plenty of physical activity, the freshman 15 might be 15 points on an academic scale. You never know.
You never do. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Here's a statistic that might surprise you, given all the talk about Muslim immigrants on the campaign trail this year. Every lethal terrorist attack in this country since September the 11th, Fort Hood, the Boston Marathon bombing, San Bernardino, all of them, have been done by American citizens or legal permanent residents. That kind of homegrown terror is the subject of a new book by Peter Bergen. He is CNN's national security analyst and vice president of New America. He studied 330 militants who either carried out or were caught planning attacks. The findings are in his new book. It's called The United States of Jihad. Peter Bergen, thanks for coming on.
Good to be here.
What are the demographics? What have you found about who these people who become radicalized in the United States, who are they?
Well, we, myself and my research team, created a database of 330 cases since 9/11 of people involved in some kind of jihadi terrorist crime, ranging from the trivial, sending very small amounts of money to a terrorist organization overseas, to the very serious, such as murder. And we found that the profile is quite different from the young potheads of popular imagination. These are average age 29, a third are married, a third have kids. They're no more likely to be to have gone to prison than anybody else in the American population. They're no more likely to have mental problems. And you know, when you take it all together, they are ordinary Americans.
How does it work then? How does it happen that these people become radicalized?
You know, that's the big puzzle, because why does an American citizen, and overwhelmingly these cases are American citizens or residents, sign up for an ideology, one of which goals is to kill other Americans? It's really a form of treason. And I spent 2.5 years researching this book, and what I can say is that it's pretty complex. It's some kind of a rich stew of, you know, personal grievances, the desire to belong to something bigger than yourself, sometimes a search for recognition, objections to American foreign policy. Is some combination of all the above.
Could this be happening, do you think, without social media and the internet and the state of interaction that we have today?
Well, that has certainly made it much more pronounced as a problem, as a potential problem. I mean, the FBI says it's got investigations in 50 states, and social media and the internet generally allows people to radicalize in their own basement rather than having to go to some radical mosque or going overseas to meet some terrorist group. I mean, so that's the bad news. The bad news is that, you know, ISIS is able to radicalize, you know, we're not talking about huge numbers, but there'd be more cases in 2015 of jihadi terrorism cases in the United States than in any year since 9/11. Mm. And we're looking at around at least, you know, something like 60 cases. The good news is that at the end of the day, you're going to be more effective if you can travel to Syria, get training, and come back. And luckily, very, very few people have been able to manage that from the United States in compared to Europe.
Part of the reason that people get radicalized is because of social media and Twitter in particular. And then part of the reason we know what's going on is because of social media and Twitter, right?
Well, yeah. If somebody's a prolific tweeter, one of the people I profile in the book is a guy called Omar Hamami from Daphne, Alabama. He became a leader of Al-Qaeda in Somalia, the Al-Qaeda affiliate there, Al-Shabaab. You know, he tweeted prolifically. In fact, he was one of the first person to really see that Twitter might be a useful way of communicating. He had 1,700 tweets, and he was killed by Shabaab.
He was killed by Shabaab while he was live tweeting the event, right? I mean, it sounds twisted to say, but that's what he was doing.
Yeah, he's probably the first person in history to live tweet his own assassination, which happened over a period of some time where they tried to kill him once and they didn't succeed, and then they finally managed to kill him. So we're in a whole different era. But, you know, he left this sort of digital trail, which was very useful for myself and other reporters who were trying to understand his journey.
It seems to me that what ISIS has managed to do here, and this is kind of a cynical way to look at it, but they've done some amazing branding, and they have been able to convince people that they have this Islamic utopia, as you say, while at the same time making a spectacle of their violence that is supposed to be attractive, right?
Yeah. And, you know, in a sense, they've crowdsourced jihad. They're saying, do whatever you can do. You know, if you can't get to Syria, you know, try and do an attack in the United States. And clearly this was influential on the couple in San Bernardino, California, who pledged allegiance to ISIS immediately after they killed 14 Americans.
Yeah, the last paragraph of the book talks about, you know, where we go from here. And you basically say it's going to be a persistent low-level threat, domestic terrorism will, and domestic radicalization for years and years and years.
Yeah. I mean, that it's persistent is the bad news. Low level is the good news. This is not going away. Terrorism's been around as a tactic since the dawn of time. And I think in another era, you know, some of these kids might have been excited by the Weather Underground or the Black Panthers or some other revolutionary organization that promised to bring utopia through violence. And so it's not going to go away anytime soon. We're here now a decade and a half after 9/11. The fact that we're still having this conversation about Americans being recruited into the jihad is kind of pretty extraordinary on one level. But it is a low-level threat. I mean, if in 2002 we'd have this conversation and somebody predicted that a decade and a half after 9/11 only 45 Americans would be killed by jihadi terrorists in the United States – that would have seemed an absurdly optimistic claim, and yet that's actually what's happened. And the U.S. government, the Bush administration, the Obama administration has done a pretty good job of keeping us safe. We're not going to hear very much of that in this political season because no one's going to say, hey, we've managed to contain the threat, but we have.
Peter Bergen, His most recent book is called United States of Jihad. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you, Sam.
This final note on the way out today, in which 92-year-old Sumner Redstone finally moves on. CBS announced today that Redstone has resigned as executive chairman. He's going to be replaced by Les Moonves as the president and CEO of CBS. Redstone owns about 80% of CBS, about the same of Viacom as well. He's been famously reluctant to even discuss handing off control, even as there have been questions about his health and his mental capacity raised. True story here, I interviewed him about 10 years ago, so he was 82 years old then. I asked him what was going to happen when he wasn't around anymore. He all but jumped over the table and made to strangle me. All righty, we're out of here. The Dow up 183 points today, about 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 12 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.5%. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.